This is Monday, November 8th. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming up, voters in Myanmar have voted for change. We'll talk with VOA's Steve Herman in Yangon. Israel's leader is in Washington meeting with President Obama.
I want to thank you again for your hospitality, but even more so for sustaining and strengthening the tremendous friendship and alliance between Israel and the United States of America.
And a devastating report on doping and corruption in sport could mean no Russian athletes in international competition. All of that and more today on International Edition. We begin today on International Edition with the election.
Here's science in a minute.
Winter, when days are short, will soon be upon those of us in the Northern Hemisphere. It's the short days that can play havoc with people's moods and well-being. Over 14 million Americans suffer from a form of depression known as seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. While experts aren't really sure what causes SAD, some think it may be caused by a lack of sunlight in the winter. To treat SAD, some doctors and mental health experts have prescribed light therapy, where patients are exposed to very bright artificial light for 30 minutes or more each day. But a new study has found that cognitive behavioral therapy was much better at preventing SAD patients from relapsing in future winters than light therapy. The study shows that this special form of talk therapy teaches SAD patients to challenge their negative thoughts about dark winter months and resist behaviors like social isolation that can affect a person's mood. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We begin today on International Edition with the elections in Myanmar. VOA's Steve Herman has been there for quite a few days now in Yangon to report on the election. And Steve, it looks like a pretty positive day as far as Aung San Suu Kyi and her party is concerned.
Yes, absolutely. They're celebrating through the night out in front of the headquarters for the National League of Democracy, her party. Here in Myanmar, they've been announcing results for not only the national parliamentary seats, but the regional legislative assemblies as well. And there's a lot to cheer about for the NLD supporters, because nearly all of the seats are being captured by the opposition party. They appeared to be on the way to a landslide victory.
Well, what happens now? That's the question. With the recent history of this country, by recent, I mean in the past few decades, one would think that maybe the military-backed rulers would want to take back some of that power. What, do they have any power to do that?
Well, what happened in 1990, of course, was when the opposition was victorious, the military refused to recognize the victory and put Aung San Suu Kyi under house arrest. Now, President Thein Sein has promised the results of this election. Some of the NLD supporters are apprehensive, fearing a repeat of 1990. But if the NLD captures two-thirds of the seats in the parliament, which they are telling us that they are confident they're going to, that could significantly reduce the legislative power of Myanmar's military, which has 25% of the seats in parliament automatically reserved for it. And if they have that sort of clout, the NLD then could make these constitutional changes that would allow Aung San Suu Kyi to eventually become president and knock out this reserve clause, which gives some of the most powerful ministries to the military as well. So the two-thirds majority is absolutely vital for the NLD if it wants to form a government and then to change these clauses in the Constitution that it does not like.
As we have been discussing earlier this week, Aung San Suu Kyi came out and said that she would be above the president. Whether she was joking or not, we don't know, but she's not been taking. Those comments have not been taken as jokes. What's the outcome of that, and what do you expect to see?
Well, she is highly revered by her supporters in this country, and there's no doubt that even if someone else is named as president, no one would doubt who the boss of the NLD remains and who the boss of the country will be. Very similar to the situation when Manmohan Singh was prime minister in India, but the Italian-born Sonia Gandhi, who was head of the Congress Party, was really seen as running the country, even though somebody else was prime minister. So there's precedent for this, not in Burma, but next door in India.
Well, a lot of people were not able to vote. We talk about the Muslim population there, Rakhine State. What about that situation? There's still a lot of people who are disenfranchised.
Certainly, there were millions of people that were disenfranchised for various reasons, and the international community has been commenting on that, hoping that after this election that there will be a way to rectify that in the future. But it is unlikely to be a sort of black eye that anyone is going to consider is not validating the election here. And both the U.S. Secretary of State, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and the heads of non-governmental organizations are all saying that these are situations that need to be remedied in Myanmar in the future.
What this might do as far as Myanmar's economy is concerned?
Well, since the normalization of relations with the United States and other countries, the lifting of sanctions, essentially, a lot of countries and companies have been very bullish on the potential for Myanmar. It's still a very poor country. The infrastructure is not in great shape. There are problems with corruption here. There's cronyism, nexus between the government, the military, and big businessmen. So this election is not going to turn things around overnight, even if the NLD is able to form a government, which it says it's confident that it will. So I think the NLD in power, on one hand, could be very good for transparency and would make American and European and countries from other nations more comfortable with doing business in Myanmar. But some of the existing relationships may be in jeopardy, and that could affect, say, Chinese, Japanese, and South Korean companies who have been very comfortable with relationships that they've had with people in the existing government who now may find themselves out of power.
Steve Herman is VOA's correspondent in Myanmar. He is talking to us from Yangon. And Steve, I thank you so much for a great week of work and for speaking with us. Another story we're covering. A Jordanian police officer gunned down two Americans and a South African before local forces shot the attacker Monday at a training center outside of Amman. Security sources say the assailant wounded two American trainers and four Jordanians at the Jordan International Police Training Center. A Jordanian government spokesman says an investigation is underway to determine the motives behind that crime. Make sure you listen to VOA throughout the day and you head to our website at voanews.com to find out what is going on and what develops with that story. Another interesting story deals with the University of Missouri here in the United States, and I'm going to let Andrew Palcheski, our social media director or the president of social media, or we will, whatever we're
called. Sounds good to me, sure.
Tell you more about it, Andrew.
Well, Tim Wolf, who's the or was the president of the University of Missouri, and the University of Missouri are two trending topics today worldwide. That's because Tim Wolf, the former president now, has resigned from his post. This has come over the past couple weeks as he's been accused of not dealing with some racial incidents on campus of the University of Missouri, one of the largest schools in the United States. People accusing the school and him of systemic race issues to the point where a photo had gone viral of the football team of the University of Missouri, big college football team. A number of African-American players said, "We're not going to play," in protest of these racial issues. So that photo went viral. It's kind of driven a lot of the issues, and now we have Tim Wolf resigning. People saying it's a new age of social activism on social media, the fact that this photo was shared and they were able to get it around and actually cause social change. So an interesting story there, one that's developing as we speak.
And we will cover that as well for you. Make sure you stay with us at voanews.com. What else is going on?
Well, we have hashtag Merry Christmas Starbucks. Now, this is a story, a pastor in Arizona, Joshua Firestein, created an uproar because Starbucks this year, usually for Christmas and the holidays, they put snowflakes and things on the coffee cups and they make them red. Well, this year they're just plain red, and they said it's to emphasize the simplicity of the season and all-inclusiveness. Well, that does not sit well with this pastor. He said that it's Starbucks has a war on Christmas, and posted this video online that went viral, and a number of people are now mocking him, saying that you can't be persecuted by a cup. Someone said, I like this one, the only offensive Starbucks cup I see is one that's empty. So I think he's getting a lot of flack for that. But, you know, it's this back and forth, a lot of Christians saying that there's a war on Christmas, a lot of people saying that that isn't the case. And so there's a back and forth on social media over that.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah. And then finally, we have Hedy Lamarr. She's the screen siren of the 1940s. She passed away in 2000. Today would have been her 101st birthday. And Google is honoring her with a doodle. Now, the interesting thing about Hedy Lamarr, in addition to being an actress, she invented a radar system that was the forerunner to Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. So we owe her for, if you're using a cell phone out there, you're listening on the internet, you owe Hedy Lamarr for that. So a nice way to honor her, and an interesting story about how she, after her acting career ended, she went and did something that changed the world.
Thank you, Andrew. Appreciate it. That's Andrew Palczewski with our social media report, and this is VOA. This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. A bombshell in the form of a report from the World Anti-Doping Agency. It recommends that track and field's governing body suspend Russia from competition following the findings by the agency of a cover-up by Russia of positive blood doping test. Henry Ridgewell is joining us now from London to tell us more about the results of that report. Henry, just give us a bit of a background on this, will you, please?
Yes, this is a commission set up by the World Anti-Doping Agency, really in the wake of a documentary that was shown on German television earlier this year, making specific allegations about the Russian Anti-Doping Agency and about its complicity in the doping of Russian athletes, and indeed with the complicity of the International Athletics Federation, the IAAF, in that doping. And it said that effectively the results of the London 2012 Olympics were sabotaged because both of those bodies failed to pick up on any of the doping allegations against questionable Russian athletes. And this commission has painted is one of what the head of the commission called state-sponsored doping, effectively, by the Russian authorities. And they've called for the immediate suspension of Russia from athletics until their anti-doping agencies meet the standards that are required. So, as you say, a real bombshell report. We were warned to expect some big announcements today, but I think this has taken the entire world of sport by surprise.
Now, this could possibly ban Russia from the upcoming Olympics. Is that correct?
Theoretically, although these are only recommendations given by the World Anti-Doping Agency Commission, they have to be taken up by the World Anti-Doping Agency itself, although it's very likely that that will happen. Russia, of course, has defended its actions. It's denied any kind of systematic or complicity in that doping, and it's called for a discussion of these allegations at the next meeting of the IAAF later this month. But if Russia is suspended because of these allegations, because of these accusations, and if the relevant authorities, the World Anti-Doping Agency, isn't satisfied that it's Russia's own anti-doping agencies are up to scratch, in time for those next Olympics, then yes, indeed, it could see them suspended from taking part.
Well, just how much power beyond the recommendation? You've just touched on this, but how much weight does this carry with the rest of the world's sports administration?
I think it carries a lot of weight. It was an independent board, an independent commission set up by the WADA, WADA, to look into these allegations. It contains the board is made up of independent sports lawyers who have looked into this. They've taken testimony from former Russian athletes. They've got different evidence, including on-camera, hidden camera footage of some other Russian athletes where they admit to doping, and that includes gold medal winners at the London Olympics. There are further allegations as well of the IAAF being embroiled into this. Allegations that they, in effect, extorted money from Russian athletes in return for giving them a clean bill, if you like. So that when their test results came up positive, they were approached by senior members of the IAAF who said to them, if you don't give us in the region of $400,000 to $500,000, we will reveal your positive test. And the allegations suggest that that money was forthcoming and those tests were hidden from public view.
Now, Interpol has already announced that it is taking an investigation, I believe they said, worldwide. How likely is this to spread, perhaps, to other countries?
Very likely to spread to other countries. I think initially they will focus on Russia, but I think the gravity and the breadth of these allegations mean it's inevitable that there will be questions raised. There are already questions raised about another a Turkish marathon runner as well. So we're already seeing other allegations pop up, perhaps even into other sports as well. Interpol, as you say, taking up this investigation from alongside French authorities who have already launched an investigation into the former head of the IAAF. And as the author of the WADA report said, these allegations are really on another scale up from the scandals that are engulfing FIFA at the moment. So really dark days for world sports. Sebastian Coe, the new head of the IAAF, has described it as such, but he has pledged to make the sport clean. It remains to be seen whether he can do that.
Henry Ridgewell joining us from London for VOA and International Edition. Henry, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
U.S. President Barack Obama is meeting with the Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. Coming up in just a moment, you'll hear more about it from someone who knows a lot. Stay with us. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Here on International Edition, we are joined by Robert Satloff, the executive director of the Washington Institute. He is a specialist on Middle East policy, and this is the day when Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu is at the White House here in Washington with President Obama. Robert, what is the focus of these talks?
The focus of these talks are as much environment and atmosphere as they are substance. The two have not met for over a year. During that time, the United States and Israel have suffered one of their most bruising political and strategic battles, namely over the wisdom of the Iran nuclear agreement, a battle that was often quite personal between the two leaders. And so the purpose of the meeting is first and foremost to restore some level of cooperation and public image of cooperation to the relationship. Beyond that, there's quite a significant agenda from coordinating their approach to the Russian and Iranian deployments in Syria and the overall challenge of Syria to the terrorist rise of that now appears to be the downing of the Metro jet, which is just over the Israeli border in Sinai. An understanding about long-term U.S. military support for Israel, which the two sides say they are committed to doing.
Just over the past few days, there was word that it was either leaked or said by some members of the Obama administration that Barack Obama was saying he doesn't see any possibility of peace in the Mideast during the remainder of his administration. Does this color these talks at all?
Well, I think it's a reasonably sober and analytical look at the situation between Israelis and Palestinians. One of the top items on the agenda will be ways to restore a measure of calm and stability to the Israeli-Palestinian arena at a time when there's an upsurge in terror and violence, often at a very one-to-one individual level where various Palestinians or Israeli Arabs are taking knives and stabbing Israeli civilians and military. So I think it's a sober assessment. I think it's an accurate assessment, but it doesn't mean that there's not important work for the two sides to do in order to restore a measure of stability and lay the groundwork for what both hope is an eventual return to diplomacy.
Well, the relationship, as you mentioned briefly, between President Obama and Mr. Netanyahu could be compared to oil and water. How do they get beyond that, if they do?
Well, I don't think anybody believes that they're suddenly going to become bosom buddies, go out drinking, put their feet up on the desk together. But they are leaders of two nations who have a strong strategic partnership, who share common interests and common values. And in that sense, it is important for them to put aside whatever personality differences they have for the benefit of their two countries. Together, the United States and Israel are facing quite daunting tasks in the Middle East. And if we can't figure out how to work together, then the entire Middle East will see that and will draw conclusions about the strength of American partnerships and American alliances. And so it really is incumbent to figure out ways to cooperate for the sake of their own relationship and for broader American interests in the region.
Do you expect anything solid to come or anything really meaningful to come out of these talks?
I think there's a good chance that that there are some very important, meaningful steps can be taken. Coordinating U.S.-Israeli approaches to a military activity in Syria, laying the groundwork for a 10-year memorandum of understanding on military cooperation and military assistance to Israel. These are no small items. And so I do think that that there's a chance for some significant products to emerge from this.
Robert Satloff is Executive Director of the Washington Institute. Robert, thanks so much for being with us. Greatly appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Make sure you stay with us here on The Voice of America. This is International Edition. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ira Melman. For our director, Patrice Martin, have yourself a wonderful evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One thing is for certain, as our collective populations grow, so will our need for energy. And just as surely, as we ramp up energy production, wherever possible, we must turn to production that is clean and sustainable. Today's global population is about 7.3 billion people. Of these, millions are underserved, and about 1 billion have no access at all to electricity. So, given that the population will expand to some 9 billion by the year 2050, in order to accommodate the needs of another 3 billion people, our energy output will need to increase by at least 80%. Even in the short term, the numbers are staggering. As Undersecretary for Economic Growth, Energy, and the Environment, Catherine Novelli, said recently, in just the next 15 years, we can expect the world will add more than 5,500 gigawatts of electricity capacity. This is the equivalent of adding all the power generation that exists in the world today. At the same time, we need to also reduce our greenhouse gas emissions in the energy sector by 60 to 80% to address global climate change. One of the most promising technological advances in energy production is distributed energy systems, including off-grid solutions, such as power generators and solar panels, said Undersecretary Novelli. And because low-carbon technologies, such as solar panels, will be easier to acquire and cheaper to run than fossil fuel technologies, she said, the vast majority of those new connections will come from renewable energy sources. The United States has recently committed to providing access to off-grid clean energy products and services to more than 500 million people by 2020. This includes a $75 million loan guarantee from USAID's Power Africa program to scale up off-grid renewable investments in sub-Saharan Africa, $20 million in loans from the Overseas Private Investment Corporation for supporting residential solar in Kenya and Nigeria, and $46 million from the Millennial Challenge Corporation for off-grid electrification in Benin. When it comes to energy, our goal is to ensure access to affordable, reliable, sustainable, clean energy for all by 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.